So we've been going through the life of David, and if you are familiar with the life of David, it starts out really good, and then we get to 2 Samuel chapter 12, and things basically take a dive from there, and they keep diving. His life really never turns around. So David's life starts out as a shepherd boy, that he's out taking care of the sheep, and God takes that shepherd and brings him all the way to being the king of Israel. As king, he then receives a covenant from God, which a covenant is just a promise between God and men. He is given a covenant that his house and kingdom will last forever, and his throne will be established forever. Whether he understood this or not, fully he was being told that his kingdom was going to last forever because eventually in his family, Jesus Christ would be born, and that the Savior of the world would be in his family. He was also a very successful, nationally renowned lyre player. So he had that going for him. I can't play instruments, I can't sing, but David could. And he got good enough at it that he would do audiences for the king, quite successful little lyre player. When he then did become king, he ruled over a united Israel. Israel was only really united for like 100, 120 years. It didn't last very long. Only Saul, King David, and King Solomon ever ruled over a united Israel. After that, it started to fall apart. So he was one of only three men to ever do that. He also had a really fancy title that God gave him, a man after God's own heart. And there's sort of two ways that people look at that it could be saying that it was sort of addressing his character, which his character really doesn't line up that great all the time with God. Probably more likely what it's saying is that he was actually the man who was chosen by God, that Saul, he was chosen by the people, that he was the king they wanted, but that David, rather, was the one that God wanted, and that he was a man after God's own heart. But either way, it's a pretty impressive title to get to put that on your resume. And I'm also a man after God's own heart. But one thing that the Bible doesn't do is hide people's faults. Often in our own lives or in the lives of the people around us, we like to sort of hide all the bad things about ourselves. We don't want to tell people what our faults are. We don't want to tell people what our failings are. We like to create sort of this aura around us that we don't fail, that we're very much these perfect people. And that can be really damaging to the people around us and to people who are looking at us and to ourselves, because we can start to believe that we really are quite special. And the Bible doesn't do that. We see with Noah. Noah builds the ark. He is used to save humanity, and then he gets really drunk and lays around in his house naked. That story, Noah, we didn't need to know that about Noah. That could have just been left out. And if we were writing our own biography, if I was writing mine, I would probably leave out the story about the time I got really drunk and my kids walked in on me lying on the floor passed out naked. That would be a story I wouldn't include. But the Bible chooses to include that story. Abraham, he lied about who his wife was, and then he doubled down and did it again. Jacob, he was just a trickster, just like a glorified con man. Moses, he lost his temper once and he murdered a man, and then he lost his temper again and hit the stone too hard. And then Peter follows Jesus. He walks with Jesus every day. He becomes a pillar of the church. But when push comes to shove, he denied Christ three times. These people who are heroes of the faith, people who we can look at their lives as an example of how to live our own, also had great failures. And the Bible makes no effort to hide those. We might make an effort to hide those and be like, this would be a nice time just to skip on to Solomon and just sort of leave this story alone, but the Bible doesn't do that, so we aren't going to do that. So first we'd like to look at before David sins. And as we've just gone over, David had lived a very blessed life. In Proverbs 38-9, it says, "Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny you and say, 'Who is the Lord?'" Here we see the risk of a life being too blessed, of having too much, that when things are going really well for us, it's easy for us to start to think that it's because of something that we're doing, that, you know, we've put this together, we worked hard, we got the career, we got the money, you know, we've built this nice little family, we've built this church that people want to come to and attend. You can really attach it to anything you want, that when success starts to come, there's a risk that you start to look at it and forget that this is the house that God built. And we start to look at it and think that this is the house that I built. And that's really setting us up for failure, because our focus has now shifted from God being the one who provides for us to ourselves providing for us. And if we rely on that very long, we're going to find ourselves starting to fail. Secondly, when David starts this story and he's up on his roof, he's home from battle. Some people look at it and go, well, why was he home from battle? David was the king. He could decide to send out his army and not go with them. It may have been a bad habit to start sort of just lazing around the castle, but at the end of the day, he was the king. He was allowed to not go with his army. The chapter before, he didn't go with his army. The chapter after, he doesn't go with his army. When they're just about to take victory, they call David out and he leads the final attack. He was probably fine to be at home. And he would probably fine to be up on his roof, that it's okay to be on your roof. They had flat roofs. It wasn't like he was just like climbing out the window to sit like in like a teen drama and they'll go sit out on the roof and look at the stars and talk about lost love. That he was just up on his roof because that's where they lived. The problem was is that when he was up on his roof and looked out and saw a woman bathing naked, that he should have left. He should have turned around and walked away. It's like when you go into the bathroom and somebody hasn't locked the door, and you open the door and there's somebody sitting there on the toilet. You go, oh, sorry, and you leave. I was out once, and there was a guy who went into the bathroom, and it was at a doctor's building, so they had the button to open the door. This poor lady came along, and she hit the button, so the door opened because he hadn't locked it. And it was... it wouldn't shut, so he was sitting there, and he couldn't get up. The lady, she just kept hitting the button, sorry, sorry, and it just kept the door open. She could not get away, and like we had to convince her, stop touching the button, and the guy just had to like wait there, really mad, waiting for that door to shut again. But your typical reaction is like, let's get that door shut again, let's flee away. But there are also times where we see things that if we start to linger and we start to focus on them, whether it's somebody naked bathing or whether it's some other thing that we know we shouldn't be doing. Gambling is really big right now. If you're into sports, we constantly have advertisements for gambling. And I could go and look at the odds and go, what would I do? Which way would I bet? And if I do that and I'm always focused on it, eventually I'm going to say, you know, I'm going to throw $100 in here and start betting on the games. And all of a sudden you're doing it because you sat there and looked. I just don't look at it. I look at the lineup. I want to know where they are in the standings, who they're going to play in the playoffs. But I can't focus on the gambling side of sports, even though they have it everywhere now, because I'll end up gambling on sports. Because we can't just stare at it and focus on it. We need to flee from it. But David doesn't flee from it. David looks at it. And then David goes to his servants and says, who is that? Who is that lady? And they come back and they tell him two things. They say, one, that she is the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Both of these men were members of David's, the Mighty Men. David's Mighty Men. So he fought with these men. He knew these men. They were brothers in arms together, and his servants come back and say, oh yeah, well, you know Eliam, well, that's his daughter, and she's married to Uriah. And instead of David then going, okay, this is something I probably shouldn't be involved in, and looking away, he goes, okay, well, why don't you go and get her for me? And now he brings her to her house, and he takes Bathsheba in, and he treats her just like any one of his other wives, and then he sends her away. And at this point, he thinks he's gotten away with his sin. He thinks he was just able to take somebody else's wife, treat her like his own, and send her back. And he'd gotten away with it. He had done it, and he was fine. Until Bathsheba sent him a message and said, David, I'm pregnant. And now all of a sudden there's a baby coming, and you can't hide a baby. Uriah is eventually going to come home from war, and his wife is going to be pregnant, and he's going to say, well, I was at war. What happened here? The sin is going to come out. And David does what many of us do. Probably all of us can look back on our lives and find a time where we sinned and our first reaction was to hide it. If our kids, sometimes they go on their phones, they listen to stories, and they get told you're not allowed to look at the screen. You just have it on your desk, and you'll go into their room and you'll see them put it down. The first thing they do is try to hide it, right? Like, and we all do that. We you know, you're watching something and you maybe shouldn't, and they come down, you turn off the TV and go, no, I'm just sitting here, just sitting on the couch. This is what I do, right? We maybe were looking at Facebook at work and our boss walks in the office and we close that up, better get going here. Right? We're doing something that we shouldn't, and our very first reaction is to hide it, and that's what David does. So his first move is, he goes, okay, I'll get Uriah to come home so that he can spend some time with his wife. So then when he comes back from war and she's pregnant, he goes, I guess we've got a baby coming. Isn't this great? So he brings Uriah home, but Uriah gets home and he goes, well, I'm not going to go and enjoy time with my wife while all of my brothers in arms are sleeping in the fields. So he sleeps at David's doorstep, and David goes, well, that didn't work. So then he decides, what I'll do is we'll have some drinks, and I'll get him drunk, and then he'll go home to his wife, and then my plan's going to work. But for all of David's flaws, Uriah wasn't going to be tricked into going home. His men were out fighting, and he was going to go make this report to the king and get back to his men. So again, he doesn't go to his wife. So he starts to get more desperate in hiding it. And what he does now is he actually gives Uriah a letter to take back to Joab, the general of the army, telling him that what I want you to do is put Uriah in a part of the battle where he'll die. So they were sieging a city. They were fighting the Amorites. And they were fighting against Rabbah. And what you would do during a siege is you would just surround the city and you would basically just pen them in, and you could get food and supplies because you were outside of the city, and you would basically try to get them to be starved out inside before you attacked the city. But what you didn't do was go up close to the city where the archers could shoot you. So what they do is they just put poor little Uriah into this group of men and they send him close to the wall and he dies. So David now has eliminated the husband, but in doing this, he's not only murdered Uriah, but he's also murdered all of the men who were with him. This wasn't just sneak in his tent and get him in the night. This was like, let's try to create this rouse, which also requires that we kill possibly hundreds of other soldiers in this effort, all to cover up David's sin. So at this point, it's not just that he's turning it off or trying to hide it. But he is now starting to sin on top of that. He's starting to lie about what he's doing. He gets all the way to the point where he's murdering, trying to cover up his sin. And often, after we sin, most of us probably haven't murdered to cover up our sin. But most of us, I would say all of us, have sinned to cover up our sin. That was our initial reaction. At this point, Uriah is dead. Bathsheba mourns, and then she comes and becomes one of David's wives. She becomes the ninth wife that we're told of David, which is also sort of fulfilling what God warned them about at the very beginning when he said, when they asked to have a king, and he said, well, kings are going to take things from you. Like, they're going to take things that aren't theirs. Like, that's what having a king is. And they said, no, we want it. And here we have David, who was the man after God's own heart, sort of the greatest king that they ever managed to have of the whole group. And he is taking another man's wife that really wasn't his. But he thinks it's all hidden away. And at the end of chapter 11, we have the final verse, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. So he was sitting in his palace thinking, I cleaned that one up pretty nice. Like, nobody even knows, and even if they're suspicious, I'm the king, they're not going to say anything about it. He thinks that it's all hidden away, but we sort of have this foreshadowing here of the Lord that he didn't miss it, that God saw it. So God sends Nathan. So Nathan was a prophet, and he then gets sent to talk to David. And he goes to David and he tells him a story of a rich man who had flocks of sheep and a poor man who had one sheep, one that he held in his arms, he fed it out of his own food, and he treated it like a daughter. And this would really point back to when they told him who Bathsheba was, and they said, this is Elam, I believe it was, his daughter, that he would treat Bathsheba like his daughter because it was, and this man was treating this little lamb like his daughter because he cared for it so much. And the rich man has a friend come over for dinner, and he's got to cook him a meal. So instead of going out to his own massive flock and choosing a sheep and butchering it up and cook it for dinner, he goes to the poor man, and he takes the one sheep that he has, the one sheep that's just like part of his family, and he cooks it up for his guest. And David hears this story, and he's just overcome with rage, and he says, this man should be put to death. Death wasn't the punishment for stealing someone else's sheep. Death was the punishment for taking someone else's wife into your home. Death was the punishment for murdering a man. But David overreacts to somebody else's sin. He looks at what they did and goes, whoa, that's horrible. That man should be put to death. And Nathan looks at David and says, you are the man. You have all of these wives. You have all of these things, and yet you chose to go to Uriah and steal his wife away from him. So David now is at a spot where his sin is no longer hidden. It's out in the open, and there's no longer any point in lying about it. There's no point in hiding it. There's nobody else that he can kill to cover it up, and he has to actually deal with his sin. And where we see really his reaction to that, we see a little bit of it in Psalm 12, or pardon me, 2 Samuel 12, but where we really see it is in Psalm 51, which David wrote after this interaction with Nathan, after his sin has been exposed. The first thing that David does is he says, have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. David realized that the only option that he had was to throw himself at God's mercy. In Sunday school, we've been learning about grace, and grace is where we've received something that we didn't deserve. We've been given a gift. And mercy is really the other side of that, where something that we do deserve is being held back. David deserved to be put to death for what he did twice. But all that he can do is throw himself at God's feet and ask for his mercy. He was completely aware that was his, at this point, that was his only hope. There was nothing that he was going to do. There was nothing that he was going to say. He just had to throw himself at God's mercy. And this can be sort of a dangerous spot to put yourself in. You're completely putting yourself into somebody else's control. And It should come as, I don't know what word that would be, but as like, we should be glad that nobody has ever thrown themselves at God's mercy and he's turned his back on them. That when David did this, it would be terrifying. There would be an element of fear for him that he's just going, there's nothing I can do. But he could also be confident that there's nobody that's thrown themselves down at God's feet. And he said, no, that one's too big. That one's too ugly. And walked away from them. David also goes on to say, for I know my transgressions and my sin is always before me. Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. So David here is confessing that he knows that a sinner is what he is. That there's nothing else really to him. Right from the very moment he was conceived, he was a sinner. When he was born, he was a sinner. He went through his life as a sinner. We really, whether or not we're sinners isn't really a question. Like, I mean, we could lie to ourselves and try to pretend that, you know, we're probably good enough, but it's really, you're fooling yourself. Because perfection is the standard. Nobody's there. And David was fully aware of that he was a sinner. The question really isn't whether or not we're sinners, but the question is, what are we going to do after we sin? He then goes on to say, against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. And when you first read this, you'd think, well, like it wasn't like only against you. Like, you know, Bathsheba got sort of taken advantage of and Uriah got murdered all at the hands of David. So you'd sort of initially look at that and go, well, we are sinning against other people. And that's true. And what he did to those people was horrible, but it pales in comparison to what he did to God. God had given him everything. God gave him life. God gave him the kingdom. He gave him all of this success. And he really just took that all and crumpled it up and threw it back in his face when he sinned against God. And for us, we can look at our sins and sort of think that those were against someone else. You know, that I wronged this person or I wronged that person. And we can sort of devalue it where we need to realize that we wronged God. That when we sin, we're the ones that are grabbing his hand and holding it down upon the cross. And as it lies there, and we take that hammer and we slam a nail through his hand, that's us doing that. That's what our sin is doing, is it's nailing him to the cross. And we can look at our sin and go, well, you know, I wronged this person, and you know, that probably hurt their feelings. And we can devalue it. Because all of that, what happens to other people, pales in comparison to what we are doing to Almighty God when we sin. And David came to grips with that. That what he was doing on a worldly level was bad. But when it came face to face with God, that was where his problem was. And finally, he cries out, cleanse me with hyssop, and I will be clean. Wash me, and I will wither. I'll be whiter than snow. So here David comes to where he just yells out that his only chance is for God to purify him. That's his only hope. And for us today, that's our only hope. We need to be aware that just like David, we're all sinners. We've all wronged God. We've picked a fight with the Almighty. And that our only chance is to throw ourselves down before him and call out to him and ask him to forgive us. And there's nothing else we can do. There's nothing we can say, or there's no book that we can read or prayer that we can even say. We just need to fall down at his feet and cry out for him to save us, because that is our only hope, just as it was David's only hope. And God does withhold judgment from David. The consequences of what David did still exist. As we continue through David's life, it really nosedives. His family falls apart. The abuse that he carried out is then carried out onto his family. God tells him that the sword will never leave him. There are consequences for our sin here on earth, but those are still the consequences on earth. Ultimately, when Jesus died on the cross, he showed us that there is no sin so heinous that he can't pay the punishment for it. There's nothing so bad that he's not willing to take our place. And when he rose again from the dead, he proved to us that he has complete victory over death. The death that we are owed, that he has victory over that. And all that we really need to do is really come to grips with the fact that we are lost and that we are sinners, and that sin is not against one another, but it is against God. And the only place that we are going to find forgiveness for that is by throwing ourselves down at God's mercy and asking for him to purify us. And just as he did that for David, and just as he has done that for thousands since, he will do that for you. If you throw yourself down at Jesus' feet, you do not have to worry, did I do it the right way? Did I fall the right way? Did I think the right thing? If you throw yourself down at his feet, he will cleanse you and he will save you from your sins.